Welcome to the Big News Podcast. I'm Peter Himmelman. We are, my guest and I, Sheldon Gomberg, and I'm going to formally introduce him in about a second. We're sitting in Silver Lake, California. For those of you who don't live in California, don't know what Silver Lake is, it is the epicenter of all that is cool, what is hip. To get here, that you go through a lot of, there's homeless encampments, which I noticed that was not here last time I was here. It just makes things a little bit more vibrant somehow. But artists are here, bohemians, you see people, the average child has a beard and a neck tattoo and nipple rings. And as you progress to teenage years, God knows what's happening. But it is a very, as I said, vibrant cultural neighborhood or community. And I always like being here. At the epicenter of the epicenter sits next to me, Sheldon Gomberg. A little by way of introduction, Sheldon is, and I reserve these, you know, sort of comments and attributions for only the best. They're always real. Sheldon is a musician's musician. Musicians everywhere will totally nod their heads in agreement. He understands the depth of music, both songwriting and production and engineering. He has a wonderful studio that he works at, and I've recorded a record of mine called, what was the name of that? The Boat, literally forgot for a second, The Boat That Carries Us. He did a live record with Jim Keltner.
Lee Sklar,
who's my favorite guitar.
David Steele,
amazing guitar player. It was basically a live recording in the studio with, you know, just Sheldon set up a very beautiful, a scene that was conducive to creativity. And what I mean by that really is, and gets to the heart of who Sheldon is, he's discerning, but he's not judgmental. And I know the words are similar, but there's a huge difference. Discerning is that he knows right from wrong, he knows quality from lack of quality, but he's not judgmental in the sense that he's letting things flow. He's not like a cork in a bottle. He lets the artist in the studio run free, and it's a really great thing. He puts his importance on having the artist be comfortable, and then, you know, naturally in second place, a very important second place, is the sound and the beautiful sound that he gets. He's also himself an incredible bass player, and he's played on many of my records. And for me, most importantly, the thing that connects me to Sheldon is the fact that he's always pushed me in a very gentle way, in a very deft and wise way, to do more. There were times when I was stuck in TV land and I hadn't put out a record for a long time. And Sheldon called, and he just somehow, in a very calm and quiet way, insisted that I make a new record. And there were three or four records that were done at his insistence in some way. So, Sheldon, welcome to the Big Muse Podcast. Thank you for the cold water from your refrigerator. Yours, with the chilly frost on the outside, made my room temperature to warm water look horrible. L'chaim, as we clink plastic bottles of Arrowhead water.
We shouldn't be admitting to drinking out of plastic bottles.
No, it's bad for you. It's bad for the environment.
I got to say, that's one of the best introductions I've ever had in the last week or two.
In the last couple of days. So that is just the introduction. I had a bunch of questions that I wrote last night when you asked us, so what are we going to talk about? And one of the things...
Don't tell them that I was actually thinking about it and getting prepared.
Well, you made vague general preparation. You have to do that to focus your mind on it. One of the questions that I'll phrase it in a different way than I probably did last night. What is it that keeps your youthful enthusiasm? It's my assumption that you still maintain that youthful enthusiasm for music. What keeps it alive? You've told me that you just have a passion to create music. That's almost your reason for living, your raison d'etre, if you will. What is it about music itself? What keeps you connected?
I don't know. It bit me when I was, you know, a teenager, and it's the best thing in the world. It's just passion for music, great music, you know. It's indescribable what it does to you when you hear great music that moves you, you know?
Does it, in some way or another, I'm just diving in, is it feel like it supplants some sort of prayer or something? Does it take that space? And
yes, to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's going to have their own. I know people that don't like listening, never listen to music. They don't like it. So I guess it wouldn't supplant that for them, but for me it does.
And you're, most of the music that you make now is you're facilitating the work of others.
Yes.
What do you think your strengths are in that area?
I should ask you that question.
Well, no, I want to know from you. I want to know. And of course, it's all steeped in your native humility. I'm trying to get you out of it.
Good luck. I don't know. I think I've definitely put energy in trying to make people comfortable and let them know that, like you said, I'm discerning and not judgmental, so they can try and fail, and you know they can make mistakes, and it's not gonna be the end of, you know, the sun is gonna rise tomorrow. You know, to feel comfortable and to be themselves and explore and that's when you get the best stuff. I think is when you get the vibe, when there's a vibe coming from the other side of the glass. I mean, you know, I was a bass player, I was a studio musician, and I've seen all kinds of producers and engineers and the vibes that they give off, and I can see when they can kill it, and I try to...
Tell me, you don't have to name any names, of course, but tell me, you know, somehow people work by negation. I'm not going to do that. You know, you learn a lot from the people that you dislike.
I think you learn more.
Tell me, perhaps more. Tell me an experience that you had that informed the way that you worked that was perhaps unpleasant or you thought was sort of stupid.
Oh, my God. First of all, my memory isn't that good. Second of all, I wouldn't want to call somebody out on something like that. But I've just been in enough sessions where, and being as a bass player, you know, I play with all kinds of different artists, different music, and part of your job is to pick up who the artist is so you can feel what's best for them and what they're looking for, and obviously put yourself into it, but. Try and see it from their point of view, and that's what I try to do as a producer. But as a bass player, I'd be in sessions sometimes watching the producer doing things where I'm like, wow, does this person understand who this artist is? This is going... And you could see the artist bristling, you know, and like not where they wanted to go and seeing that this person didn't get them. And I just swore that I never wanted to be that guy. I didn't ever want to put a stamp on it. Like, you're doing my record. No, I'm doing your record.
Right.
And my job is to make your record the best it can be, whether I succeed or fail, you know, that's the idea.
It's almost a statement about who you are as a human being or who this, you know, unnamed person might be. The music is the ultimate conversation. It's like, you know, I hate to use this, probably a tired simile, but it's like sex, you know, it's a communication. It's a very depthful communication. And when you're not responsive to those around you, it's a one-sided communication. And in some ways, it fails to be music.
Yeah, I agree.
So when you're in there, what do you look for in a good song? What do you kind of... Is it a feeling? Is it something structural?
I mean, a great song, it's, again, it's indescribable. I'm not someone who breaks something down like that.
Right.
I either feel it or I don't. And when you feel it, it's undeniable. But my job, to me, my desire, my passion is when I'm going in and working with someone, let's say we're doing an album of 10 songs. And let's say one, I mean, I'm not a hit guy. I'm not someone who's going, okay, no, that's not a hit. Let's not do that. Let's say out of those songs, you know, 8 or 9 of them are like, those aren't perfect, you know, but I can see this is who the artist is. I may talk to them about strengths of where this song can go. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could work on this section. This doesn't flow quite right. But in general, if that's what the artist wants, that's what I'm going to try and help them get the best of that they can, you know.
Right, rather than rework their whole...
I'm not a songwriter. I mean, I was years ago, but I haven't done it in so long. And I don't want to assert myself into somebody else's songs, you know. And you know, that being said, I'm lucky enough that I get to work with songwriters like you, who is like, what the hell would I say to you?
You said good things. One of the things that you did for me, and I think it's an important part of the production process or something that a producer does is that you listen to songs. Let's say there's 10 songs on an album, but the artist comes with, you know, I came with 30 songs. 30,
you came with like 60.
Yeah, I mean, when I write a lot. You know, yeah. They come out like, you know, like salamander eggs, and then they stop. But that was an important process, and I learned a lot about what you liked in the songs, just based on the things that you picked and you gently eliminated, you know, and the songs that you didn't pick, I also learned some things from. With me, I also know that you're very attuned to the lyrics as well. It's not just a melodic thing.
It's funny because I think you're right about that in a sense, and in another sense, I'm not really a lyric guy. I mean, I definitely love great lyrics, but I don't know that that's the first thing I listen to. Well, the story, yeah, or whatever it is, needs to. I mean, if they're dumb lyrics, of course I'm gonna.
See, I think about lyrics probably like you do too, and I, you know, I'm very interested in lyrics and so on, and I agree. It isn't necessarily the story or even the meaning conveyed by the lyrics, but there's something about the musicality,
yeah,
and the rhythm of certain lyrics wed together, and if there's a falseness to that, you call it phrasing, I guess,
yeah,
where that lyric is, it's sort of sticking out and arrests the hypnosis that you would otherwise feel. In other words, really good lyrics continue to draw you in. They possibly don't include cliche phrases, or if they do, they're done for some reason.
Yeah.
So that you're constantly being drawn in. And if you hear something false, the fishing reel that's being, you know, brrr, you know, it stops, and the fish is like, "What's happening? I'm not coming in anymore."
But you can be focused on it. You can have lyrics like "The Boat That Carries Us." I mean, those are great, simple, great, and those just drew me in. I mean, that's like a classic song to me. Or it can just be phonetic. You know, it can be the phonetics can just run in a nice way, and then you don't really think about,
yeah,
you don't have to think about the lyrics, or why does that not make sense? Well, it makes sense to you, not me. You know, I mean, the phonetics could be like, wow, that kills me. That's great.
And who knows? I always, when I talk about songwriting, sometimes I give some workshops and things, and I say, look, I will give you guys $100,000. Whoever can say exactly what Strawberry Fields means, what is it about?
It means forever.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Come on, give me the money.
What does "Tangled Up in Blue" mean?
Yeah.
You might not know what it means, but you certainly, on those really well-executed lyrics, you feel many things. And ideally, I think, the greatest lyric, you draw your own life to.
Just gonna say that, yeah.
Right, and it's obscure enough that you can inhabit it with your own experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on that. That's, yeah. Everybody should be able to get something different out of it, whatever it means to them.
Right. You know? Right. There are songs that are very literal. Certain country songs, or you know, I've made a bunch of children's songs. You played on some of my kids' records, right?
I played on My Lemonade.
My Lemonade Stand. Yeah. Right. And those are always very literal, you know, those songs. But even so, you can get something out of those.
What was that about your dog, Twilla?
My dog, Theo.
Theo.
My recently departed dog, Theo. Yeah, that was the lead-off track. Have You Met My Dog Named Theo?
No, but wasn't there one that was like something in Vanilla?
Oh, Willa. That was Willa. We had...
I had it close to
Willa. Yeah, exactly right. Theo was a border collie. And so we thought for a moment that we would be well in our house to have two border collies. So we got this female dog named Willa. Hey, little Willa, chocolate and vanilla with a little scoop of caramel on top. Hey, little Willa, chocolate and vanilla. She's a running it, you just don't stop. You know. And then we got rid of her after about a month and a half. She'd wake up at like 5 in the morning, antagonize our dog Theo, our more mature dog. They would be running around in a circle in our bedroom.
That's what I remember.
Yeah, right. It's like, it was really funny at first. Yeah. And it's like, no, this is not happening. And then Willa you know, somebody took Will away and there was some crocodile tears for about 15 minutes and we never saw her again. We're assuming she has a great life now.
I hope so. I had a cat, greatest cat, and at one point I thought, well, you know, I'm out doing sessions and tours and gigs all the time, but let me get him a friend. And I got him a friend and he never took to him, you know. And I'd always hoped that they would bond, but then it never did. And at the end, when he got diagnosed, you know, with liver cancer and kidney failure and stuff. And so then I made a deal with someone where I was like, okay, you take my, because I wanted him to like the rest of his life. So I got rid of the other cat. I had a friend. I was like, look, I'll give you a day in the studio if you take this cat.
You really wanted him to have a good, and it was a hard challenge. You give a liver sick cat to somebody.
Yeah. Well, no. My good cat, I kept him.
Oh.
And the new cat that I got to try and be a friend with my old cat, that's the one I got the new house for.
Very sweet of you. Now, I have a tortoise now that we're getting into animals. My tortoise is a male, and I know that they're very hard to sex, but I had a tortoise that I assume was a male, and now I know it was a female. And how do I know that? Because when I would hold this tortoise and it would become agitated, it would just become agitated. My new tortoise, when it becomes agitated, reveals from some hidden anatomical sheath something that is decidedly male. I mean, and relative to the size of the tortoise.
That's about as much as we need to get into
that. Exactly. So there is no mistake about this. I do have a male. And so I'm concerned that at some point this tortoise have some sort of mate. You know, that it will know the joys perhaps of turtle fatherhood and so on. And right now he's a solo cruiser. Doesn't even know that another tortoise exists.
So you need to go out and find a tortoise and agitate it to see if it shows its maleness or whether it's a female.
I'd like it to become a father at some point.
So the one that you had that you were doing the
That was called King Ferdinand.
So that was actually a female.
Yeah. So it was actually Queen Isabella. This was a tortoise that we had on a show that I was doing on the internet called Furious World. I had like pre-recorded questions from the tortoise, and one of them for Jim Keltner was, "Have you?" And I pitched my voice down. It was like real low, and I used like an auto tune to pitch it down. Jim, have you ever come up with a rhythmic pattern from a dream? They were really good questions, and he started to answer that. Of course, the turtle didn't have any answer, but he was agitated. And he shit all over Jim, actually, all over his jeans. It's an indelible stain from kale, which if you ever want to stain anything a murky green, give it to a tortoise, allow it to.
So how many hours do you need for that whole process to happen?
You probably got to give yourself 12 hours, and it's not sure that it's going to happen. So it's like any art form, you never know. Now, speaking of never knowing, Have you ever had
That was a better segue than going into the whole.
Yeah, well, that was a natural sort of segue. This was an unnatural, forced segue. But you brought attention to it as though anyone would have seen it or heard it. Have you ever had a project that just for one reason or another didn't work out? Or in the middle of it, you thought, this is going to need some real work. I mean, and what was the feeling then?
Oh, man.
Like, that you just weren't happy with it.
I've been lucky. How do I put this? I've been lucky in that I'm not, quote unquote, open to the public.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, it's a behind closed doors here.
Like some fucking drunk guy. Top 40 band can't call me up and go, hey, man, we want to, you know, Weekend Warriors.
Right.
And so I've been able to work with just because I played with everybody, so I know a certain level of quality. And I've been able to keep that level up pretty high. And I've gotten to work with a lot of great, great people. But I've had a couple that were miserable. And one in particular was miserable, and that was just, God, I don't even know where to go into that.
I mean, was it Was it musical? Was it, it was emotional, personal?
Just nightmare person. And I had another one that was actually a really good guy, but he, the way I described it was he knew enough to get into trouble, but not enough to know to get out of the way and let me help him get out of it.
Uh-huh. I mean, you need to get into a little trouble.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. You need
to experiment. And.
But then if you're just muddying the waters, that's what I'm here for, or somebody like me.
Right, you sort of have to like guided play or something, you know.
So, I mean, I would get to the point where I'd go and I like single-handedly blame this guy for making me hate music. The first time in my life, I'd never want to. Like, I look forward to going out and playing or going out and recording. And this was this guy I would actually credited with single-handedly making me hate music.
For 14 hours or something.
Until we finished the record, which is, I like the guy, he's a nice guy, but we had to re-record the record like two or three times.
Oh, literally just basically start over with all the songs.
Well, yeah, basically, because,
it's interesting.
I don't want to go into why.
I mean, you get into a space, when I always think about professional musicians, or, you know, who knows, I'm sure it's the same with playwrights or business people that are going to start a business, you know, to go in another direction. The business or the album or the play is going to get done because, you know certain skills. When we undertake to make a record, and you give yourself whatever, 2 weeks or 3 days, whatever forcing frame. I'm always kind of amazed that it just gets done. And sometimes things turn out, I think, if you have the right players around you and you're ready to let them bring what they bring, it comes out better than you could have imagined. And that's, let's just say, would you agree? That's one of the huge joys of this experience.
And that's, to me, that's a lot of it is, getting a feel for what the songs are and who the person is and then picking the right players. If it's not a band, if it's a solo mm-hmm. artist, picking the right players for the thing, and then letting them do their thing. You know where to steer it if you need to, but let them go and see what they do. It's probably going to be better than you can imagine.
I remember when we were messing around with the record that we made, and it wasn't like they'd rehearsed. I'm not going to get Jim Keltner to come to a bunch of rehearsals. Right. And whereas I had this one groove in my head, and that's how I'd play the song over and over, and Jim was like fiddling with his sunglasses while I was playing it, and I don't know all his visual cues or anything, but I understood that he just wasn't digging it. Remember that? It was Hour of Ebbing Light.
No.
Yeah, and then I totally changed the groove to something totally different, like a shuffly kind of, and all of a sudden he put on his glasses and he started playing.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's the take.
Because I'm back in the control room.
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
And
happen.
You notice the take, we just went for it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody'd ever heard it in this way, but Jim is the kind of drummer, Jim Keltner, he's played with, who's he played with? I mean, John Lennon, he's played.
George Harrison.
George Harrison. He's
Leon Russell.
He's done anything you could ever imagine, right?
It goes on and on and on.
So
Steely Dan, Ricky Lee Jones.
He comes with all sorts of experience, knowledge, deep facility, deep mastery, and you could tell him what to do. Because I had, certain drum beats, like every guy that's not a drummer has an idea of how the drum should be played. Boom, boom, gakakum, like, and Jim doesn't want to hear any of that. You give him that boom, boom, gakakum, he'll go, zhunkakum.
But the next time he plays it, it'll be
something different,
just as great.
And it's all good, and you have to say, screw it. You just go with it.
I mean, you got guys like Keltner and Lee and Lee Sklar, and it's like,
you just got to see where they take you. And you have to have, have a certain amount of trust. The record's important to me. I don't want to go down some like weird rabbit hole. There's time and money, and it's all limited. But it's almost like you say to somebody, I trust you. Show me what beauty you can bring.
Mm-hmm.
It's the greatest thing you can bring to a kid or to anyone. You know, show me, not in a mean way, show me what you got, but like...
In a trusting, nurturing...
Show me what you encouraging. Got. It's a good feeling. You did that. I mean, you made me feel so special. It's unbelievable.
Well, you are.
No, you know, you never know. Even if it's hype, it's so well done. I fall for it every time. But that is to say that making something, making music, or it could be anything, it's a very delicate, seductive process. It's like you're asking somebody to sort of take off their clothes in a certain way and become extremely vulnerable.
Especially for the artist.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's different if you're the musician, which some people can be very nervous about, but the artist is, you're bearing everything.
Well, and two, I mean, not to, you know, leave the musicians out. You know, you want to hear what they have to play and hopefully...
But I mean, they don't have the same level of...
Of investment.
Maybe. And being naked. They're playing and they know that if you go, oh no, go a different direction, they'll go a different direction. It's no big deal. The artist is bare with, here's the song, here's the performance, here's the lyric, it's everything, you know? The artists are definitely the ones that have the most to be nervous about or shy about or whatever. So you guys have the most on the line.
Well, I like changing things a lot with these people that I respected. I like changing it up in the moment. And I always think, this is my, you know, axiom, is maybe not true. A well-written song should be able to be played in a million styles. And maybe we're just talking about the songs that we know. I was just saying to somebody, like, things that Kanye West on this new album, what he's doing, and different, you know, different people out there. It's, music has changed so much. And to the extent that I like it a lot, but I cannot grasp it. The rhythms have changed. My rhythm, and probably yours too, like our rhythmic paradigm is running down the road, trying to loosen my load, I guess. You know, that's a song. That's, you know, the paradigm of a song structure. And things that you grow up with as a kid, those familiar rhythmic patterns that get into your bloodstream, into your DNA, they can't be erased, and it's very hard to replace them with something fundamentally different.
It is fundamentally different. It's a different. It's almost a different form. Well, it is a different form. That's why it's got a different name, you know, to the style it is. And it's almost like it's a different subsection of music.
And I see that as... You're talking about, you know, say Kanye West and hip-hop or whatever it's, the name is now, but it's not only that the music is different, it's that the purveyor of the music, the inventor or the player of the music, is seeing the world in a fundamentally different way. And I think that's the difficulty. In a real artist, the music he or she makes is a manifestation of their conception of the world. And that is, seems to me, now I can't put a name on it. It's hard to put a name on anyone's conception of the world. But that's what's difficult to grasp, as difficult as the differentiation of the rhythm and the melodies. That's why old people go, it sounds like noise. No, if you were in my mind, you might understand more clearly why this is happening.
Yeah.
It might make more sense to you, but your construct of the world is such that this music is in such contradiction to it, it is sounding to you like noise. So tell me what's on tap and, you know, coming in that's exciting into your studio.
Oh my goodness.
Or things in the past that have been really exciting.
Well, I mean, Peter Himmelman record was really exciting. That's a great record. That was a lot of fun. The thing that I'm, you know, I've been doing these records for the Sweet Relief Musicians Fund, which are really a lot of fun to
right.
do.
Right, yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, Sweet Relief Musicians Fund was started by Victoria Williams when she got diagnosed with MS back in like 1993 or two. She was on tour with Neil Young, and she had to leave the tour. And she all these people, and I can't remember the first album or the second album, who was on which one, but, you know, people like Pearl Jam and Lucinda Williams and Michael Penn and a bunch of different people like this did her songs. And it raised so much money for her that she had money left over. She started this charity to help other musicians.
So she was the one that started the whole... What's the name of the charity? It's
Sweet Relief Musicians Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did two records, one for Vic and then one for Vic Chestnut. And that was 93 and 95. And then they hadn't done any in since then. And they helped me a few years ago. Well, 10 years ago when I started having trouble walking for MS. So they helped me, and I was talking to them about something, and I was like, well, maybe I could help you for what you've done for me. Maybe I could, you know, make a record for you, because I know a lot of people. And so I put together the idea and presented it to them, and they loved it. And so I made this record, which was their third record, which they hadn't done one in a long time.
Was it specifically geared? I mean, or was it geared to a specific person?
No.
Or just a general?
It was a general
fund?
Yeah, we had a theme, you know, based on giving or take, people in need, giving or taking. I'm trying to blank on it. But anyway, so we had a bunch of people like Ron Sexsmith and Ricky Lee Jones and Jackson Browne, Shelby Lynn, Ben Harper, She and Him, a whole bunch of different people did songs. And it was a blast. Peter Max did the cover.
Right.
Got a real Peter Max, which is really great to me. And so I've done another one and just finished it. I'm just shopping it right now. So just starting, actually tomorrow will be my official starting.
So have you begun recording on it?
It's done.
Oh, it's completely done.
It was done a year ago. It's just the last year I wanted to get all the contracts taken care of and with the artists. And it takes a long time to do that.
So. Tell me a bit about, you know, talking about selling even these kinds of records or charitable enterprises. I mean, what is your take on where the music business is heading, or, you know, how do you process? Because there's been so much disruption and change. And
I'm the last guy you should ask about that. I just do the music that I like, and I don't really pay much attention to what's... I don't want to say I don't pay attention to music, but I don't pay attention to what's going to be a hit or not. I just make music that I think is good, you know?
Right. I mean, it seems like all the musicians that record, so many of them, people still make records. And you must know that people are not consuming music in terms of a collection of songs by a given artist.
Yes.
But, and yet, I know it well. I'm in the process of making another record too. Frankly, I don't give a damn. You know what I mean? It's really like that. It's not like weird defiance. It's just that there's something beautiful about this form of a collection of 9 or 10 or 12 songs that may or may not cohere somehow.
Can you imagine Dark Side of the Moon in singles as opposed to a whole concept album, you know? I tend to like albums.
Well, I do too. And I mean, it just could be, and I've said this many times before, it's like the saddle industry never disappeared. There are still people that love horses, you know, and they ride. It's just not the way that we transport ourselves from here to there. It's right. It's not the standard entertainment.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, back in the day, they used to have singles. I mean, even the Beatles, the singles weren't on the records, were they?
I think every album had one single on it that pushed the album. I don't know how it works.
So I think that a lot of their singles came out weren't on the records themselves, I think, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the artists that you work with and that I know, and, you know, we're not putting out singles anyway. Never.
Yeah, right.
Never really did. I mean, they were introductions to an album. You know, they were never meant to be taken as just a single unit. But I mean, people still like to make records. I think people like to make records more than people like to consume them.
Well, it's interesting. One thing, you know, this Kickstarter and Pledge and those crowdsourcing things. One thing that I've kind of noticed is people tend to like, that's a weird concept for me to go out and do one of those, you know, and ask people, give me money.
Yeah.
But people tend to like to be part of you making it more than they like to be part of buying it, you know?
Well, I mean, there's a whole psychology to that. I've done two of them. One is that you generally love what you give to, whether it's a child or mm-hmm. a relationship or an instrument, you know, you have a deeper, not only a financial investment, but what you give to is what is on foremost in your mind. And there, it creates an opportunity for people to love music again by making that investment. It's a stronger connection to something. And perhaps the idea that you had, in a very real way, something to do with this being manifested.
Support, yeah.
And if it's just, you know, music, recorded music is so ubiquitous. And it's when things are everywhere and you didn't have to work for it, not to get too crazy, but there's a Kabbalistic concept, which is the fundamental, it's called the bread of shame. That, I won't go into all the details, but the gist of it is that people, it's really a question of why is there struggle in the world? Why can't we just open our arms and be given everything? This is like a question to God, let's say. And the reason is that people, and you hear it in the most microcosmic way, meted out in this record analogy, it's everywhere and it's free. No one loves it. The only way that you can be truly invested in something is if you've gone through the toil of helping to bring it into the world. Mm. The bread wasn't given to you. Just take it as much as you want. That's like a shameful thing. But you've worked for it. Again, that's just a philosophical concept. Sometimes you go, well, that's way too much, you know, toil for any human being to deal with. But it does remind me of that in a very small way. Ladies and gentlemen, you've got a taste of the mellow, intuitive, sensitive, responsible, manly, and creative Sheldon Gomberg. Give it up, my man. All right. Thank you for joining us on this riff of the Big Muse podcast. And thank you, Sheldon, for hosting me and for giving me a fresh
water,
cool Arrowhead water.
Oh, man, there's more where that came from.
I'm going to have me another drink.